So it's great to be back. And I'm sorry, I guess I was away for about a month, but it's good to be back and to hopefully get back into some learning. We have been talking about the different sfirot, the different godly displays or ways in which a person can recognize God's hand in the world. And then we were trying to apply it to ourselves, how we can derive from that practical practices. So then we spoke about kindness being rooted in the importance of choice, or choice being rooted in the sense of kindness being a source, being original, being independent. We learned about the opposite of being independent is a sense of a real absolute faith and everything in the hands of God, to surrender sometimes, and when we should look at the world through the lenses of choice, when we should look at the world through the lenses of surrender or faith. We learned about different models of leadership. We've learned about, finally, the last real core was about King David, who is the great paragon of humility, negation of self. And what creates King David's greatness is that he's all about the glory of God. And that's called the attribute of malchut, the attribute of kingship. The attribute of kingship is to be empty, to receive, and ultimately through that being empty and receiving, something much more special emerges. So think to the earth. The earth is called the symbol of the attribute of kingship. The earth, I have to move it around and create an empty space and drop into that empty space a seed. But what the earth then produces out of that seed, whatever, however long it takes for it to germinate and grow, a month or 2 months, something so much more special than what I put in. And that's a tremendous lesson, that when we subdue ourselves and humble ourselves and make ourselves into a vessel, what will come out ultimately is going to be so much more special than what goes in. So that really, just to again to summarize the 10 sfirot, or the 10 statements with which God created the world, are called in Hebrew keter. Keter is will. He spoke about will, pleasure. Chachma, wisdom. Bina, understanding. And then in terms of the emotions, chesed. Chesed is loving or giving. Gevura is restraint, holding back, strength. Tiferet is balance. Netzach is the leadership of dominance. Hod is the leadership of empathy, of really putting the other person first. Yesod is the balance of heavens and earth, being a tzaddik, being a righteous person. And finally, malchut, kingship, is the level of absolute negation of self. Now, these levels are hinted in the name of God. Talmud relates a story, I think Rabbi Wilds probably mentioned this story in one of his classes, that when Moses was in heaven, he saw God putting little lines on top of letters, crowns on top of letters. And Moses said to God, "God, why are you putting these little crowns on the letters?" And God said, "Because these crowns are going to actually remind a sage, many generations from now, of all sorts of piles of laws. Great amounts of law are hinted in these crowns." The Kabbalists teach that the name of God, which is the main name of God, is Yud Hey Vav Hey. Sometimes you'll see in a book it'll be called the Tetragrammaton. The name of God, of his essence, or of his creating the world. It's really a composite of three words. Hayah, he was. Hoveh, he is. Yihyeh, he will be. That God transcends time, that he transcends existence. It also is related to the word mehaveh, that he brings the world into existence, that God creates the world. The name of God of creation is Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Kabbalists teach that the crown on top of the yud symbolizes the attribute or the sphira, the divine emanation of Keter, of crown. The yud itself symbolizes chokhmah, wisdom. The hey symbolizes bina. The vav has a numeric value, a gematria value of 6. It symbolizes chesed, gevura, tiferet, netzach, hod, and yesod. And the last hey again symbolizes malchut. So to explain. The Kabbalists say that a way of remembering it is to think of the following. If you look at the shape of the letter yud, it looks like a little dot of ink. That's like a coin. And if a person wants to give charity, say I decide I want to give some charity, so I take my coin. What am I holding my coin? I'm holding my coin in my right hand. How many fingers are in my hand? 5. The second letter of God's name is Hey. The numeric value in gematria of the letter Hey is 5. Because every letter in Hebrew has a numeric value. The first letter, Aleph, is 1. The second letter, Bet, is 2. The third, Gimel, is 3. The fourth, Dalet, is 4. The fifth, Hey, is 5. So the Yud is the coin. The Hey is the right hand. That's 5 fingers. The 5 fingers holding the coin. Now, to actually give the coin to somebody else, I need to stretch out my hand and connect with him. That's the letter Vav. The letter Vav is the letter of connection. In Hebrew, if I wanted to say the word and, I just say Vav. I and you are going to the store. Ani va'at holchim lachanut. I just added a Vav in front of the word at. Ani va'at, I and you, holchim lachanut, are going to the store. The Vav is the word and. The Vav is connection. So actually the word Vav literally means a hook. A hook connects two things together. So, the coin is the yud, the hand holding the coin is the hey, the connecting between the two people is the vav, but then I have to hand my coin over to the recipient, to the poor person. So that's another hand. I'm going to put my coin into his or her hand. The hand again is 5 fingers to a hand. That's hinted by the final hey. To go a little deeper, in Hebrew, the letter hey is what denotes the feminine possessive form. So for example, if I want to say, this is my table, I would say ze shulchani. This is my table. I want to say, this is her table. Ze shulchan, and I add a hey. Ze shulchana. This is her table. I want to say, this is his table, I add a vav. Ze shulchano. The hey is the feminine possessive. In fact, the letter hey at the end of a word typically denotes that it's in the feminine tense. So the sfirot, the two letters in God's name that are hey, sort of the feminine letters, first hey and the last hey. In terms of the sfirot, first, the coin is chachma, is wisdom. The hay is bina. Bina is already a feminine concept because the Talmud says women have a lot of bina, have a lot of understanding of details. The vav again is a masculine concept. The connecting, but the hand that receives the final hay is again a feminine concept, a feminine who receives from the masculine who's giving to her. So within God's name, the crown on top of the yud represents the highest point, the will. The yud represents chachma, wisdom. The hey represents bina, understanding, because that's a feminine concept. The vav represents chesed, gevura, tiferet, netzach, hod, and yesod. And the final hey again represents malchut. So within God's name, yud hey vav hey, we already have hints to these 10 different understandings that we've been learning about all year. Kabbalists say an amazing thing. They say the whole world was created with God's name. God revealed his name and created things in the world. So throughout the world you will find fours. All of these fours correspond to the four letters of God's name. And it also actually corresponds to the Sfirot. So there are four universes. There's a universe called Atzilut. It's the highest universe. It's the universe right next to God. And the word Eitzel, next to. That's a universe that a person reaches through attachment with God. Beneath the universe of Atzilut, which corresponds to the letter Yud, you have a universe that corresponds to the letter He. That's called the universe of Bri'ah, of creation. That corresponds to the letter He, corresponds to the Sfira of Bina. Beneath the universe of Bri'ah, there's another universe called the universe of Yitzirah, of formation. The universe of formation corresponds to the letter Vav. It corresponds to the emotions of loving, of restraint, of balance, of dominance, of empathy, and of creativity. And finally, the last universe is the spiritual world that animates our physical world. That's called the universe of Asiya, the universe of making. And that corresponds to the last letter, Hey. Let's go to history. There's an amazing tradition that Judaism has. Yeah, question.
So Asiya is what we are making, or the making of us?
The world of making is called Asiya. It's not just that we make, but in this world, making matters. Things matter. Let's apply it a little bit from the abstract to the practical. Sometimes a person feels a sense of inadequacy. I'll give you an example. I get into my car, and my synagogue was very, very kind. They leased the car for me. I said, Rabbi, you're in the car a lot. We know you like to listen to Torah lectures. So they leased the car with an MP3 player, so I can actually listen to an MP3 file. So I get into my car and I say, listen, I'm going to go down now from Inglewood to the city. I have a half hour in the car, I'll listen to a lecture. That's what I say, I want to listen to the lecture. What do I actually do? I turn on the radio and whatever. I listen to some music. I don't listen to the lecture. So now I walk in, I feel a little bad. You know, I had a half hour that I could have used in a really great way. I didn't use it in the best way. At least what I would have considered the best way. The truth is, that's all assuming that the only world I'm living in is the world of making, the world of doing, of actually accomplishing. But if we open up our minds to the concept that there are other universes, this world is the world of doing, of making. So in this world, actually doing something is very significant. But there's a world above this world. That's the universe of Yetzira, of formation, which, as we've learned, corresponds to kindness, to restraint, to balance, to dominance. All of these are emotions. So a good emotion, a good feeling, means something in the world of Yetzira. And above the world of Yetzira, there's an even higher world. That's the world of Bria. The world of Bria corresponds to Bina, to understanding. So if I understood that I should be learning, so that counts in the world of Bria. Okay. Did it do anything in the world of Yetzirah? No. Did it do anything in the world of Asiya? Also not. But it did something in the world of Bria. So that's already something very significant. So that really can give a person a tremendous lift to realize that in our world, actually doing something, something concrete, action, object, that takes up space. But that's just our world. There is another universe, as grand as our world, which is all emotions, and emotions are really significant there. So a good emotion that a person has, I want to help somebody, I wish I could help somebody, that's already an achievement in the world of Yetzirah. And a good thought is an even higher realm, that's an achievement in the world of Bria. So that can be a fantastically ennobling and inspiring thought that, okay, yeah, maybe I don't have yet the realm of action, but the realm of thought, or the realm of feeling, these realms counts a lot. It's really mystically even higher than the realm of actual action. But why four realms? Atzilut, Bria, Yetzirah, and Asiyah. Four realms to correspond to the four letters of God's name. The truth is there's another point within the top realm, within the Yud, there's a crown over the Yud that corresponds to Keter, as we've learned. So that's true, there's a universe within Atzilut, which is even higher than Atzilut, called Adam Kadmon. But basically, there's a correspondence between the four universes and the four letters of God's name. God made a world, and this is actually how we started our learning together. God made a world of tremendous balance. To enable choice, there's tremendous balance. So you have a Jacob. Jacob has a twin, Esau. And they're brothers. So Jacob is a simple person who loves to study and very kind and honest. And Esau's an opposite. He likes to wage war. Talmud says an amazing thing. It says that Jerusalem always had a sister city, at least during the times of the Second Temple era. And that was Caesarea. Caesarea was a non-Jewish city that was brought into Israel, initially by Greeks, and then Romans populated Caesarea. And there was always a competition between Caesarea and Jerusalem. The Talmud says, if somebody tells you Caesarea is booming and Jerusalem is booming, don't believe it. But if somebody says Jerusalem's booming and Caesarea is going through a very, very difficult recession, you can believe it. And if they say Caesarea is booming and Jerusalem's empty, you can believe it. Because there's a world of balance. You know, there's the side of blessing, Jerusalem. There's the side of the opposite of blessing, Caesarea. There's the forces of good, and the counterweight to the forces of good, Caesarea, the Romans, the people who destroyed the temple. There's always going to be a counterweight. So we've learned there's a whole realm of holiness. We can say there are 10 stages in this realm of holiness. You could take the 10 stages and divide them into 4 stages, the 4 universes, the 4 letters of God's name. So just as there's a realm of holiness, there is a parallel, and that parallel realm is the realm of the non-holy. And it corresponds to the realm of the holy. It's like two sides of a scale, and they're equaling each other out, so that man will always have a choice, people will always have a choice, to choose that which is good. So we've learned that there are 4 letters to God's name. The 4 letters to God's name create 4 universes, 4 levels of holiness, the level of actually doing good things, the level of feeling the right feelings, the level of thinking the right thoughts, the level of attachment to God, that's the highest. Just being attached to God, just feeling His presence, being attached to Him, living with Him, living with a bond with the Almighty. That's the highest level. That's Atzilut, next to God, being one with the Almighty. So the same way, there's 4 in the realm of holiness. There's 4 in the realm of the opposite of holiness. So let's start over the course of Jewish history. First temple was destroyed. My memory is not so great. I think it was the year 586 before Common Era. 568, something around those realms. The first temple was destroyed by the Babylonians. Just to remember, to review, the Jewish people had been in Egypt, and Egypt really grew from being 70 individuals to becoming a nation by the time we left, of 600,000 soldiers. That's not counting the women. not counting the elderly, it's not counting the children. So probably several million people by the time we left Egypt. We leave Egypt in the year 2448. We go out into the desert. We get the Torah at Sinai. In the year 2488, we actually enter into the land of Israel. We spend 980 years in the land of Israel. So from Egypt, we had a period in the desert, and then we were in Israel for 980 years. And you have to imagine that if we would be living then, let's say we're living in the year 950 of that 980 years, it'd be hard to imagine that there would be an exile. And exile was something that happened 1,000 years ago to our ancestors in Egypt, but now we've come to Israel. Israel's never going to be destroyed. But unfortunately, because of our sins, we did lose the first temple after it stood for 410 years, because the first 570 years of our living in Israel was without a temple. We had a temporary temple in Shiloh. We had, before that, a temporary temple in Gilgal. There was a period of time we had no temple. But after those years in Israel, we eventually are exiled, and we go to Babylonia. The king who exiles us is Nebuchadnezzar. And just as an aside, historically, what I just said was known as a fact of history. In the 19th century, there were academics in mostly German universities who wanted to find flaws with the New Testament. And because of that agenda, they developed a school called the School of Biblical Criticism, whereby they started to claim that first the New Testament, then it moved on to the Old Testament, was not actually an accurate historical record, but it was something that was put together by a bunch of editors, or maybe one editor, Ezra Sofer, who took different documents and put them together, but really it's not a seamless text. Really, this history never happened. And the history of the Bible, they claim, never happened. And that picked up, and it became almost, I would say, accepted wisdom in many universities today, that, we don't know anything really about the Jews of the First Temple era. You'll hear people say, we don't really know what Judaism was, whether there was a First Temple. Yasser Arafat, may his name be obliterated, in the year 2000, when he was given a chance to make a peace treaty with Israel, said he wouldn't do it because the Temple Mount was not a place where there ever was a Jewish temple. There never was a Jewish temple. It was a Muslim area. It's called Haram el-Sharif. And there never was a Temple Mount. There never was a Jewish temple. So there's all this, you know, falsehood out there claiming, or call it historic revisionism or biblical criticism, whatever you want to call it, attacking the Jewish narrative, the traditional narrative. So just as an aside, when I was in Israel recently, I actually had the privilege of sifting some of the dirt from the Temple Mount. What happened was around the year 2002, the Arabs on the Temple Mount wanted to make some new construction. And so they started digging into the Temple Mount and taking these truckloads of dirt out and dumping it out of the West Bank. And they took about 100 tons worth of dirt out of the Temple Mount. Now, in that dirt were all sorts of historic archaeological specimens. Initially, the Israeli government didn't even want to sift the dirt because they were afraid of the Arabs getting upset. But right now, there is a project ongoing. If you go to Israel, you can go to this project. It's on Mount of Olives, where they'll give you a pail of dirt from the Temple Mount, from this garbage heap where they brought these 100 tons, and you can actually sift the dirt to find things. In the dirt, and I saw it, there are Babylonian arrowheads from the time of 586 BCE. So what we know from our scripture, that the Babylonians came and destroyed the first temple, we actually have now physical evidence from that very place, that from the Temple Mount, there are metal Babylonian arrowheads, there are Babylonian idols that have been found in this dirt from that era. And even more so, we even found a seal of a Kohen who's mentioned in the book of Jeremiah in the dirt of the Temple Mount. So we at this point know that so much of what was said in the 19th century attacking the Jewish narrative is not true. That there was a temple, the temple was destroyed by the Babylonians, and the Jews went into exile into Babylonia, which today is Iraq. When the Jews go into exile, the prophet tells us that the king who took the Jews into exile, his name was Nebuchadnezzar. Also, as an aside, Saddam Hussein was obsessed with Nebuchadnezzar. He thought he was another Nebuchadnezzar, and he named